Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with James Nolan, whose new book is Between Dying and Not Dying, I Chose the Guitar, The Pandemic Years in New Orleans. James Nolan, a fifth-generation New Orleans native, has written poetry, fiction, essays, is a well-known translator and longtime teacher. His previous book was the poetry collection, Nasty Water. Today, we're talking about his new memoir, Between Dying and Not Dying, I Chose the Guitar, The Pandemic Years in New Orleans. James Nolan, welcome back to The Reading Life. It's been too long.
It's been since 2018, I think, when I published Nasty Water. Yes. I'm very glad to be back here.
And in between, we had the pandemic.
Yes. And the, you know, it's funny, the title, Between Dying and Not Dying, I Chose the Guitar. People always ask me, well, did you learn to play the guitar during the pandemic? And I said, no. It's a quotation from Pablo Neruda, with entre morir y no morir, elegí la guitarra, which means that I chose the imagination.
Yes.
So writing this book was my guitar. That's what the title means. This was how I got through the pandemic, was writing this book. This was my guitar.
Hopefully there will not be another pandemic, but this would be very useful if there were.
I wouldn't bet on that.
No, either one.
Yeah, this is a book,
it's very personal.
Written for the future, I think. Because I think that there are all kinds of scholarly accounts of the Spanish flu epidemic and the yellow fever epidemic, but there are very few first-person accounts of what it was like to live through these pandemics, these plagues. Samuel Pepys, who lived through the 1665 a bubonic plague epidemic in London, wrote a present tense chronicle. But even Daniel Defoe, who wrote Journal of the Plague Year, it was a posthumous book of fiction, actually.
Did you want to read a section about that? You have written beautifully about it.
I wanted to read something about the history of plagues. So this is a present day chronicle of my life during the pandemic. I was living in the Luling Mansion on the third floor of the Luling Mansion by Bayou St. John. And I had been living there for about 5 years. And it was an interesting place because from one corner of the balcony, I could see my family, Creole family tomb in St. Louis number three. From the other corner, I could see my grandmother's house where my father was born on Verna Court. So I felt well situated there. Part of the plot of this book is that it had a new owner, and I was evicted in the middle of the pandemic while they were making a vampire film. Amazon was making a vampire film.
You can't make this up.
I can't make this up.
I mean.
And the first day, March 20th, which was when all this begins, the Amazon crew was there painting the walls purple and scarlet. And when I came back, they were all gone, and the shoot was canceled because
of the
pandemic. I hoped they would have gone away, but then I started reading, and I read The Mask of the Red Death, in which Prince Prospero retreats into a castle, which is purple and scarlet, and to escape the plague outside. And so I realized that that was the plague color palette. but in my family, fifth generation, you know, we've been through lots of plagues here. I come from an intergenerational household on the Seventh Ward. Mm-hmm. Now, my great-grandmother lost four siblings to yellow fever in the 1880s.
Wow.
And she lived with us until I was about seven. so I got to know her pretty well. She never talked about her lost siblings, but she was deadly afraid of leaving screen doors open to let mosquitoes mm-hmm. in, and of any standing water.
Of course.
Yeah, and then my grandmother, Mamère, was a young mother during the Spanish flu epidemic, and she was a maniac about cleanliness.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered where these personality traits came from, and it wasn't until this pandemic that I realized that what happens to you during the pandemic distorts your personality forever.
That's right.
Yeah, and so I wanted to read this. My grandmother, of course, would say, you know, wash your hands with soap and water before you sit down at my table.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandfather would say, well, wash my hands, but I won't use soap. Because he had a great sense of humor.
Had to draw the line somewhere.
Had to draw the line somewhere. And she would clean the receiver of the telephone every day with alcohol, rubbing alcohol. That's how fanatical she was.
I've known people who've done that.
Yeah. But this is about the times that change. And the times always change, but once traumatized, people seldom do. We can recover from diseases, but a visceral terror, once awakened, will seize us forever. What I learned from these older family members, as well as from both Defoe and Camus' novels, is that, like war and natural disasters, if plagues don't kill you, they can cause lifelong personality disorders. I wonder if I'll spend the remainder of my days surrounded by skittish people, scarred by self-isolation and distrust, socially distanced for life, like those lone figures staring out through window panes in Edward Hopper paintings. Many have already become digital versions of Emily Dickinson, and like the reclusive 19th century poet who insisted on whispering to her visitors from around corners, now avoid any face-to-face or voice-to-voice personal contact in favor of glowing screens of electronic communication.
So true.
So true. In my readings of Purple and Scarlet Plague literature, I've discovered that each epidemic leaves the lingering imprint of an aesthetic pathology, a profile of the individual attack from within, in the same way that war literature leaves a unique image of how societies react when besieged from without. Just as those isolated figures in Hopper's paintings staring vacantly through windows seem emblematic of the coronavirus, the ethereal pallor of Mimi in Puccini's La Bohème captures the haunting tragedy of the young dying from tuberculosis. The stench of decay that man conjures in Death in Venice calls to mind the very fetor of cholera, in which the contaminated backwaters of the toothless poor invade the garden parties of the wealthy. Yellow fever is a swamp miasma, buzzing with insidious insects in the simmering stupor of a tropical summer. And the ancient curses of the Black Death and smallpox represent the crippling disfigurement of the once perfect human form, Adam and Eve covering with fig leaves their bubonic buboes and pustules of pox as they stumble exile from the Garden of Eden. In the same way that war tends to unite people, epidemics separate them. If an enemy's sniper shoots off my arm or a foreign plane bombs my city, I know whom to accuse and can identify my allies and foes. But when my own body betrays me, invaded from within by some communicable pathogen, and the contagion comes from those close to me, whom do I blame? The intrusive virus or my neighbor and friend? Albert Camus' The Plague begins with hundreds of bleeding dead rats. The real rats, as we later find out in the novel, are the narrator's fellow citizens, not unlike the shoppers today at my neighborhood grocery, who scurry away from each other with beady rodent eyes staring out above flimsy cotton face masks.
Mm. And you extend all that to three plagues that you've lived through personally, of course.
Yes.
Polio, AIDS and COVID.
Exactly. I was this wasn't my first rodeo. I was 5 and 6 years old during the polio epidemic when the swimming pools were closed and most playgrounds were closed, and I got the polio vaccination in the second grade in 55, and I was very lucky to avoid it in 54 when it was defective and 20,000 kids got polio and died. Yeah, including Ashton Oshner's daughter, who he volunteered for the vaccination.
So surprised.
And so my guitar of the imagination at that point was that I had an imaginary friend named Derek who I didn't know was imaginary. And my mother told me years later, asked me about my imaginary friend. And I said, yeah, he had a limp. I think he had polio. And she said, you adopted an imaginary friend with polio? Because we were terrified of those iron lungs, which we were.
Of course.
In Life magazine, there were photographs of the iron lungs that they put children in. And then as a bisexual man living in San Francisco in the 80s and the 90s, San Francisco and Barcelona, I lived through that in which at least half of my friends dropped dead. Mm-hmm. So this is my third pandemic. And in each pandemic, I have been the target audience as a child with polio, as a bisexual man in San Francisco with AIDS, and now as an older person with, as they say, underlying conditions for the coronavirus. I've also lived under restrictive regimes in my life. So I was kind of, I recognized what was happening. Even though I lived in Spain for 10 years teaching, I had visited for 3 months Franco, Spain. And I recognized what the restrictions were, you know, living in a restricted society where you couldn't go home. There was a curfew at midnight and you couldn't go into your own home. You had to look for a sendero to let you in the street. It was really pretty intense, very dark and depressing. And just like the pictures of the French Quarter they showed during the pandemic when it was completely deserted. And then I lived in China right after the Cultural Revolution. I was teaching at Beida University. That was very, very intense. Our mail was opened. Our telephone calls were screened. There was a guard booth in front of the foreign expert complex where any visitors had to sign in. It was extremely strict. I told my work unit, as it was called, that I wanted to go to the movies. And they said, well, we'll have to write you a letter of introduction. And then I lived in Colombia for a while during a state of siege when they were trying to suppress the guerrilla movement. And at any moment, the bus could be stopped and they would go through all our bags. And so I was used to living in restricted societies. And so I knew what was happening with the coronavirus restrictions.
Did that make it better or did it make it worse?
For me, it made it worse. It really did. I really feel sorry for young people. They shouldn't have closed the schools. I firmly believe that. Someone has called them a lost generation. 3 years of remote learning. It's created unorganized crime and people that are lagging behind in math and reading skills. Any school will tell you that.
I was so struck by that passage you wrote about how war unites us and plagues divide us.
Yeah.
Because that was just so quietly profound, because that is exactly what happened and it's continued.
I think it has, and I think it was only in May 3rd, 2023, that Dr. Vivek Murthy, the head of the National Health, the CDC, announced a new epidemic of loneliness and lack of social connection. So, I mean, you can't expect people to tell people to hide under their beds for 3 years and then and then declare an epidemic of loneliness and lack of social connection. That's what happened.
There I'd be under the bed with the dog.
Exactly. That's what happened to people. And in New Orleans, you know, as Andre points out in his foreword, you know, we're a city of fun-loving, people-loving creatures. And certainly there's no social distancing during Mardi Gras or Halloween or Jazz Fest. And so it was particularly hard for people in New Orleans, I think.
Yeah, I do too.
Mm-hmm.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with James Nolan, whose new book is Between Dying and Not Dying, I Chose the Guitar, The Pandemic Years in New Orleans. One of the other things that struck me about this book is that there was still so much going on around you at the Luling Mansion, which is such a character in this book itself. So talk a little bit about that.
About the vampire movie?
Yeah.
Well, as I said, on March 20th, 2020, they were beginning to paint the walls. They were getting ready to make the movie. And then with the announcement of the pandemic, they stopped painting the walls. The trucks all disappeared. And I thought, well, Amazon's going to cut its losses and film this thing in a studio somewhere, you know. They came back probably 7 or 8 months later, and it was the first film authorized in the state of Louisiana to be shot. And so the health precautions were intense. People had to leave through one gate and exit through another gate. They had to be tested 3 times a week. They wanted to put us tenants in a hotel downtown, but I insisted on staying in my apartment where my papers and my books were. And so I couldn't leave my apartment for 3 days. They came and delivered my mail and left my garbage in front of my door on the third floor. There were visqueen screens everywhere. Of course, everyone was in face masks. I don't know how they shot it in face masks. It was called Black as Night, and you can look for it online. And I thought that was, well, I thought, what a racist cliche, Black as Night. But it was, in fact, a black vampire movie. So luckily it was shot at night when I'm usually awake. But I couldn't turn on the radio or television because they would hear it on the second floor. So I had to creep around while Klieg lights were shining in my window.
Oof.
And then at the very end, when they finally, after the 3-day shoot, I opened my front door and there was an eviction notice taped to the door on the very first day that evictions were legal in the state of Louisiana. And suddenly, from total isolation, I was thrown into the chaos that you might know about of dealing with real estate agents and lawyers, mm-hmm. and taking buses and going to banks and signing leases. And it was really a shock. And people, it was very hard to do business during that time.
Oh, of course.
Very, very hard. It's very hard to get anyone on the phone. Everyone was working remotely. So, yeah, a lot was going on. So I finally found another place. I liked living in the Luling Mansion. I always joke with my friends that moving from the French Quarter to the Luling Mansion, which faces Our Lady of the Rosary, mm-hmm. the cupola of that, was like moving from the brothel to the Vatican. except that I had to go up 4 flights of stairs to get to the Vatican. So I moved, and where did I wind up? I'm on Bourbon Street. So I'm back in the brothel, but on the quiet side of the brothel, on the other side of Esplanade in the Marigny.
But we always think of you in the French Quarter.
I spent a lot of time there, and it's become less and less of a neighborhood and more of a sort of backdrop for tourism.
Right. So when were you able to start teaching again?
That was a problem because the conference room that we used at the cotton mill, and I was working only with advanced students who were working on concrete book projects, and a lot of them didn't want to come back because they were afraid of contagion. Mm-hmm. So I gradually eased them back by having the first session at a student's house, which was very spaced out, and everyone was free to wear masks or not wear masks. And I gradually got everyone back on board and started teaching again. And I think people were relieved. They were having Zoom sessions for emotional support, mm-hmm. and wanted me to teach by Zoom. And I said, I cannot do. How could I teach creative writing by Zoom? You know, how can I say turn to page 43, the second sentence of the third paragraph on Zoom? You know, it was like a priest friend of mine said he was asked to hold mass by Zoom. And he said, but I can't get the communion wafer through the screen. And mass is not mass without communion.
Of course.
So, yeah, I felt the same way, that a class was not a class without actual physical interaction, physical, personal interaction.
Well, when did you start to feel as normal as you're going to feel again? Can you pinpoint that?
I guess in the last, it began with the first Mardi Gras parade I went to, which was, I think, in 2023. Mm-hmm. And I saw Hermes, which I had been a page in.
Ah.
And my family was, part of my family was in Hermes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt finally a little bit normal again. And it was an interesting scene, which I recount in the book, that it was a parade based on a Greek theme. And it was Sophocles receives the Book of Revelation or something. It brought to mind Thucydides, who wrote the history of the Peloponnesian War, which was about a war between Sparta and Athens. And it took place during the plague. And he ends each chapter with, "This occurred during the Great Sickness." And he uses an interesting Greek word, which is ulgra, which means rage.
Uh-huh.
And so what I saw in each pandemic or plague that I studied was ulgra, rage.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was standing there watching this float crying, and this little girl handed me three Hermes necklaces.
Oh, yes.
To this older man in glasses who with tears running down his face. So that
knew what the Greek words meant.
Yeah, who knew what the Greek words meant. But I think we see this ogre, this rage around us all the time, and it's
Well, did this put this to rest in any way for you? I mean, did writing this every day, working on this all the time, put you at ease in some way or calm?
It gave me something. It did calm me, and it gave me something to focus on. And it was sort of like, you know, practicing a musical instrument. And and again, it was a mixture of anchoring my daily observations. There's a lot of first-person narrative, present tense, first-person narrative, but it's all anchored in historical comparisons with past eras of plagues. What I learned, I think, is that history doesn't repeat itself. History rhymes. It's not exactly the same, but it's very, very similar. So just as we weren't really sure what was causing the coronavirus, you know, and with the bubonic plague, they didn't know for centuries what caused it. They thought it was person-to-person contact. But really what it was the fleas on rats. Mm-hmm. And so people were locked up inside their houses with their rats and avoiding each other. And then, of course, the government was failing, just like ours started to fail during the pandemic, so that the authorities ordered the killing of all cats and dogs, which is the one thing that controlled the rat population.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the yellow fever epidemic, they shot cannons into the air in Louisiana to dispel the miasma, they said, of the swamp. And they advised people to sleep on balconies and in courtyards to avoid contagion inside. And of course, that's where the mosquitoes were. And it wasn't, you know, I said I lost my family members in the 1880s. It wasn't until 1900 that they really discovered that it was the yellow fever was spread by mosquitoes.
You always have an eye for the thing in history that we should have avoided.
Well, that's it. And we don't, I think very much on parallel lines, we don't know all the ramifications of COVID-19 or the...
And we won't for so long.
And now so much is coming out about long COVID and long haulers. And I just read an article on the front page of the New York Times about people that were seriously damaged by the vaccine, which I was very glad to get. So, again, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes.
I've learned a lot from this book, James. We've been talking with James Nolan, whose new book is Between Dying and Not Dying, I Chose the Guitar, The Pandemic Years in New Orleans. You can meet him Thursday, June 6th at 6 at Octavia Books. James, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Susan. It's good to see you again.
You too. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The William Faulkner William Wisdom Creative Writing Competition has extended its deadline to June 30th for all 9 categories. Novel, nonfiction book, novella, short story, novel in progress, essay, poetry collection, individual poem, and short story by a high school student. For complete information, visit www.faulknersociety.org. Winners will be announced at the Society's Fall Festival, September 26th through 29th. Mark your calendar for the Symphony Book Fair Friday, May 31st to Sunday, June 2nd at the University of New Orleans Lakefront Arena. Hours are Friday, 9 to 8, with an admission charge from 9 to 3. Saturday from 9 to 6, free admission, and Sunday, 9 to 4, with free admission. Offerings include books in 50 categories, music, including sheet music and recordings, DVDs and audiobooks, art, and a special children's book sale Sunday from 11 a.m. to 2. Proceeds support the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra. Check out lpovolunteers.org/bookfair for info. And get your bourbon glasses ready as the Walker Percy Weekend returns May 31st and June 1st to St. Francisville with 2 full days of speakers and events. Check out walkerpercyweekend.org for tickets and info. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, with major support from Rouse's Markets. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.